Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Most agencies who go to the bargaining table with their federal union already have a clear starting point for negotiations. But for the Defense Health Agency, that's not the case. After starting practically from scratch, the American Federation of Government Employees has just signed off on a brand new union contract. It outlines workplace policies and union rights for 38,000 DOD health workers across the country. Federal News Network's Drew Friedman got more from AFGE Deputy General Counsel Kathy McQuiston.
It looks like basically like our VA unit, right? We have a nationwide agreement. We have hundreds of locations in VA. They're all under a single master agreement, single contract nationwide. And so DHA now in its structure looks like that. And so to get the consolidated and a contract to apply to the consolidated unit, to the totality of the 38,000 people we represent right now, we engaged the agency and asked them to agree to basically, with some minor modifications, roll over the agreements we had finally gotten bargained for headquarters and expand the coverage of those to the entire consolidated unit, because we had just bargained them, you know, in the last 6 months. We had gotten them through agency head review. So we're like, why? There doesn't make sense for either side to sit down and start from scratch when we've just bargained something with you, agency, that is, you know, appropriate for your agency. So, you know, that discussion took a few months to get that in place. And so it came in place last Friday. DOD approved the agreement. So that, as of that date, April 5th, the agreement applies to all 38,000 people in our professional and non-professional consolidated units.
And this is an interim agreement, correct? So what does the process look like for making this a full collective bargaining agreement and expanding on some of these provisions?
If you look in the date and duration article, you'll see that in there the parties have agreed to continue bargaining. I guess I would say bargain a full nationwide contract for the consolidated units within 90 days, begin that process within 90 days of the approval of this. So there's, you know, a concrete commitment to add to this agreement. So we're kind of building it, so to speak, one article at a time, because, you know, it's very rare these days in the federal sector to bargain a contract from scratch, right? That you have no contract. Most contracts in most agencies exist, and you reopen certain articles, and the agency wants some changes, and the union wants some changes, but you always have as a baseline that prior agreement. And here, there's no prior agreement. So you're literally starting from scratch, and, you know, you have to bargain everything for the first time. And so that's, you know, can be very time consuming. And we certainly didn't want to sit around for years bargaining, you know, a 50 article agreement, which is, you know, we may end up with something like that. But, you know, waiting year, having nothing during those years, right? So this was a recognition for both parties that we put some basics in these, what we decided jointly were basic matters that are important to sort of have rules of the road for both the union and management to follow. Not having a contract or any rules in place for 38,000 person workforce is going to lead to a lot of chaos. It's probably going to lead to a lot of litigation. And I think both sides recognized and acknowledged that. And so made an effort here to do something right away and have it in place while we work on the larger agreement.
Then in that case, what are some of the things that haven't really been addressed yet, or that you're going to be looking at kind of hammering out a little bit more?
Well, I think that, you know, there's no specific list. We're also working on establishing our bargaining council, which is comprised of the employees who are elected representatives from among the workforce at DHA. So again, we're internally getting that group set up, and ultimately they will be responsible for sort of making the, doing the bargaining, making the calls on priorities. So I think we're right now in discussions about, what articles will move, and we certainly want to get the views of the workforce about issues that are important to them in the workplace day to day and incorporate their concerns. So that's all sort of a process that's happening right now. So we don't have any set list at this point until we get the input from the employees.
And Kathy, you touched on this a little bit already, but this agreement covers tens of thousands of employees at DHA. What does this mean for them in terms of things that are going to change?
Yeah, I think it is going to have a huge positive impact on their working conditions of the civilian employees, because, prior to their being transferred and combined in DHA, they, the Army had their own rules and regulations, Navy had theirs, Air Force had theirs. So everybody was, dealing with different rules, different policies, and, they didn't have the bargaining authority was at, basically at their hospital. Like, they weren't, engaging with the Navy or Army, like MedCom, the medical command. They weren't negotiating things at that level, right? Like, they were, MedCom would make decisions, and they would, send them down to, the Fort Womack Army Hospital at Fort Liberty. And this is an agency level unit. So we're dealing with the Defense Health Agency. We're not bargaining with a particular medical treatment facility about decisions that are made at the DHA level. We are at the DHA level. So now the representation provides the opportunity for employees to engage at that level and have input and influence when the decisions are made, before they're made, especially with, the Biden administration in the last couple of weeks has put out, new guidance on labor management forums. They've previously issued executive orders and guidance about pre-decisional involvement. Being at the DHA level gives us an opportunity at the decision-making level in this agency to have those opportunities. So, hopefully the agency will honor what the Biden administration has told them to do and allow us those opportunities. So I think they're going to have a lot stronger voice day to day in their working conditions, a much better opportunity to have their concerns and issues heard at the highest level by General Crossland, who's the head of DHA. And I think it will provide a better workplace for the employees at the end of the day, because they're going to be in, be in the room at when the decisions are made.
Kathy McQuiston is Deputy General Counsel at the American Federation of Government Employees. She's speaking with Federal News Network's reporter Drew Friedman. You can find Drew's story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down, so I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well.
Thank you.
Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.